And thank you guys. Listen, it's such an honor to be here. I've known Keith and Jerry for decades, since probably before I was born. They're much older than I am. But, and I was only 6 years old in high school selling weed to my teachers. The other thing I think I'm qualified to speak on, I've got a lot of crazy clients, of course, like any of us who do criminal defense. It's a mental illness, and mental health is always an issue. And then, further, I have, can you hear me? Am I okay? Closer. That's that better? Okay. Listen, I sing sometimes. You would think I would know. Lips on the mic, but you know, it's kind of strange. And I've always been interested in freedom. I think I was asked some years ago, what's my personal agenda? What's my life about? And I think it's creating freedom. And what we are doing in this room with Normal is creating freedom. Freedom for people to enjoy cannabis, people to do what they want to do for their own lives, and the opportunity to help others and to expand that freedom for all of us. It's been my kind of role in doing that, to try to keep people out of prison, keep people out of jail. But we've got some issues, and I really appreciate that Normal is paving the way for not only for marijuana and cannabis, but also for other things that will come down the road following this. It's like, this is the first step in freedom for all of us in a huge way. We still have the highest percentage of our population in prison, incarcerated in the world. This statistic was true in 1985 when I started practicing law, and it's still true today. I don't know that this means necessarily that we have the worst people, that we have the most criminals, that we, you know, that we're like some sort of bad people in this country. I don't believe that, not for a minute. But I do believe that we're incarcerating people for things that ought not to be incarcerated. A mental health hospital, somebody is here from Wichita Falls, where there is a mental health institution in Texas. When I was a kid, it was Rusk Hospital for the Criminally Insane. It's still there, as I recall. And there's another place, I believe, in Texas. But whereas we have these hospitals that are there, they've not grown according to the population that we've put in prison. We keep adding more and more people to prison. We have private prisons now. Years ago, I was driving on the road going to the office, and I saw a billboard. And this was during the big fight where billboards are bad. We need to get rid of them because they're an eyesore, yada, yada. This billboard said, billboards provide employment for 5,362 Houstonians. So I started thinking, yeah, well, cancer provides jobs for probably hundreds of thousands of Houstonians. I mean, with our big cancer program, seriously, people come from around the world to be treated for cancer in Houston. So it's huge. It's a huge business. And crime is a huge business. We got our burglar bars, we have our locks, we have our alarm systems, we have the jails, we have the prisons, we have the people who run those things, we have the people who, the engineers who run the buildings of those things, we have all the law enforcement people, we have all the, you know, and it's endless, millions and millions of dollars, billions in the crime industry. And so, whereas I had this fantasy that we would reduce recidivism. I had a project that I was working on a few months ago to reduce recidivism. And it's starting with a very small population, maybe, you know, 17 to 20-year-olds with nonviolent crimes. Just seeing what we could do with a certain small group to reduce recidivism in that group and then expand that to other groups. When I realized that nobody in charge of criminal justice was in favor of reducing recidivism. Recidivism is required to support this huge industry of crime, right? I mean, if you think about it, it kind of goes. Okay, now, anybody have mental health hospitals or facilities, adequate facilities in their state? Anybody? Okay. Adequate, yeah. Yeah, no. We might have a hospital or two, right? But we've got nothing adequate to treat the people in most of our prisons, and I'm going to give you some statistics on that. Now, mental health, I have to tell you, Nat Manshay is a big friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine. He's also a friend of Keith's and Jerry's and probably lots of other people in this room that I may not know. But he's also a fabulous lawyer out of Tucson doing a lot of good death penalty work. Natman and I were at a meeting once and talking to a couple other guys, and a new guy at an NACDL meeting who was about to speak to the group, and he wanted to know what it was like to speak to this NACDL group. And somebody said, well, Natman just tells jokes for an hour. Whatever his topic, he just tells jokes, and he is really funny. So I said, I got a joke. They said, tell your joke, Mary. I told my joke. Natman said, Mary has content. So, thank you. But I do have a story, a brief story I want to tell you about Martha and George. George and Martha were inmates at a mental health institute in Texas, and they'd been there for a little while, and they'd become friends over time. And one day, they're walking by the pool together, and George just jumped in the pool, and he went to the bottom, and he stayed there. Martha dove in after him, drug him to the deck where he was treated, and he was fine because he wasn't down under the water very long. Everything seemed to turn out all right. So the next day, the chief psychiatrist of this institution went to Martha and he says, I got some good news and some bad news. The good news is that your action yesterday showed that you have really good, strong, appropriate thinking. And we think that because of that act yesterday, your act of heroism saving your friend, you're qualified to leave this institution now. Okay. But the bad news is, right after this, we went to check on George in his room and he had hanged himself in this bathroom and he's dead. Martha said, oh no, he's not. He didn't hang himself. I put him there to dry. So, sorry. I just somehow, my twisted sense of humor, I love that. Okay. How big is the mentally ill population? It depends on the definition of mentally ill. The Department of the Bureau of Justice reported in 2006, and again, I have to apologize. There are no recent studies that I could find. We worked for hours looking for more recent studies. So some of the statistics I'm going to give you are older than I'd like them to be, but I don't think they've actually changed. So 2006, 1.26 million breakdown, which is 45% of federal offenders, 56% of state offenders, and 64% of jail inmates were defined as having mental health issues because they were receiving some sort of treatment, which is, you know, not that much. What about all the people who are not defined by the Bureau of Justice and are not receiving treatment, so they're not counted? I suggest to you, obviously, it's a whole lot worse. When the profile of a mentally ill person, you know, it's funny, I can't, my eyes are so bad. It's in these contacts. I'm sure it's not my age. Women represent the largest proportion of the incarcerated mentally ill generally, while men represent a higher percentage of the antisocial personality disorder. One of the things we do, like I had a psychologist call me yesterday, we've got a capital murder case where the guy's kind of out there, and we agreed to not test him for the things that would define him as any kind of personality disorder, which would be, of course, used immediately to slam him hard. So we have to be real careful about testing they would do with our clients, and I was grateful to have a good psychologist to help me figure that out. But we do have young men with these personality disorders, this antisocial disorders, and they're diagnosed as children. You can find television programs and YouTube shows about that. Those under 20, not surprisingly, have a higher rate of mental illness, and those over 55 have less mental illness. So some of us in this room are probably disqualified from being mentally ill, and I'm really happy about that. Caucasians are more likely to report mental illness than African Americans or Hispanics. I'm not sure what that means, because I know that different cultures have different attitudes about mental illness, and some people say, well, that's that mental illness or that PTSD thing, that's for those people in that other cultural group, not for my group. We don't do that kind of thing. I'm not sure. So I think there's an issue there related to that. Mentally ill people, 75% of them were unemployed when they were arrested. So obviously employment and work is a big deal. 28% were receiving illegal income. I'm not going to go into details. Use your imagination. 40% had a general physical medical condition at the time. And all were twice as likely to have been homeless before entering the arrest situation than the non-mentally ill. So you've got mental illness and homelessness, which is no surprise to any of us who are in the system, working in the system. We all know that. But it's just, the statistically, it's kind of interesting. And statistically, you wonder what we're going to do about it. And I guess what I'm doing today is bringing you some issues and some problems, and hoping that I can inspire some people to think about those issues and those problems, and trying to help us figure out what the solutions are, because we've got a big problem. And again, Normal is doing what it's doing to decriminalize marijuana. Hopefully that will, and obviously it should, branch and expand into decriminalizing other things like homelessness, mental illness, other drugs of choice that are not necessarily harmful or don't necessarily are not involved in criminal activity, as the common people, even us in our common sense, define it. So what is the treatment of a mentally ill offender? 65% of inmates identified as having severe psychiatric symptoms received no mental health treatment while incarcerated. 33% diagnosed with a mental illness reported being treated. So people die in prison and in jails for lack of treatment, for just absolute neglect. I was lucky some years ago. I had a good friend who was arrested for DWI in Houston. He'd had one glass of wine. When they did a breath test, it showed extremely low. There was no indication he was on any kind of drugs, which he was not. He was diabetic. He was in a diabetic situation, and I don't know what it was exactly, but they got him to the hospital. He was treated, given insulin or food or something. I don't know. And he ended up taking insulin by injection twice a day for the rest of his life. That was lucky for him, okay? How many people just sit in their jail cells untreated, seriously ill, and untreated and ignored and neglected, and they die? And there are lawsuits, great. And I acknowledge those of you who pursue those lawsuits, because they need to be pursued, because the sheriffs and the jails and the cities have to be held accountable for the custody, for the people that are in their custody and care and control. What can be done? Obviously, we need reform. Scarcity of mental health facilities is a huge problem. We've got to figure out how to change prisons and jails some into mental health facilities, so people can be treated, and treated as humans rather than treated as criminals. One of the sheriff from Cook County said that these guys end up here because we're the only system they can't say no. The police sometimes are encouraged to have to approach mentally ill people to try to diagnose or to assess at least whether or not they're mentally ill, and to put them in an appropriate program or an appropriate facility, but often they're unable to do so because they have no real training. There's no funding to train them. They have no real interest, because their interest is getting the bad guys. And honestly, if you're not wearing a blue suit, then you are the bad guy, right? We say that up until the mid-90s, mentally ill people who were arrested were treated exactly the same in entry to the jails facilities as non-mentally ill people. That supposedly has changed. The states and counties are recognizing the problem to some minor degree, and they're saying they're trying to divert mentally ill people from straight jail incarceration into some more suitable facility. But I'm not seeing, again, any real change in that. Crisis intervention teams. Anybody ever heard of a crisis intervention team? Great. There's one. Okay, there's two, three, four. Okay, that five. Great. Well, that's great. I'm not seeing a lot of it. I'm certainly not seeing a lot of it nationally. But these people are supposed to be trained to interact with offenders, to assess their situation, and to put them into some sort of placement other than straight into a holding tank with the rest of the prisoners. Unfortunately, there's a real shortage of places to put them due to probably a lack of funding and a lack of facilities due to a lack of funding and a lack of training for these individuals who are supposed to be these intervention people. All right, so jail screening, some people exhibit mental illness. Sometimes they're able to be put right away into a place, but most county jails are not doing what we think they should be doing, because they're not putting people, because they don't have the money to put the people, and they don't have the facilities. I had a patently schizophrenic client a couple of years ago, a capital murder, where he was experiencing visits from the dead person, the person he had killed, in his jail cell. He was experiencing visits from his family in his jail cell. He was hearing auditory hallucinations telling him different things. The jail personnel, however, thought he was completely normal, because when they asked him, did he want his food, he would say yes or no. So obviously he was completely normal. They ignored his completely apparent symptoms, and just a casual conversation with him would have revealed his thinking and his inability to, and or his difficulty at least with relating what was going on at that moment with that person he was talking to. But the jailers think he's normal. Chronic schizophrenia. His family also thought he was just a little weird, so they never sought treatment for him. And of course, there was no treatment available because they were poor. Which culminated in a really nice man being killed in a little schizophrenic fit. All right, mental health courts. We have a few of those. Houston has now a veterans court, which is not per se a mental health court, but veterans do have sometimes, of course, mental health issues based on PTSD and those sorts of things. So I'm grateful that we are branching out a little bit. Anybody in your county or your states have mental health courts? One. Yeah, okay, so good. We got a few of those. About a third of the group, it looks like, has some mental health courts, so that's good. We're trying to do that some in Harris County. Mixed reviews. The problem with mental health people, and I saw it just a couple of days ago in a normal court where somebody was pro se, clearly intelligent, but clearly also a little bit off the wall, so to speak. That's my term for mentally ill. Telling the judge wanted to read word for word a motion he had previously filed. And the judge had to discourage him from reading that in open court when he got, 100 people waiting to have their cases heard or disposed of that day. So how do you balance that? The mentally ill people with the attention and that they need and the treatment that they need, and also getting the rest of the normal calendar handled. It's a big problem. And some judges are more or less graceful about doing that, as you know. Switching horses on you a bit. I talked a bit about recidivism, but nobody's really interested in reducing recidivism except probably us. And once marijuana is legalized, of course, that will reduce a lot of it. When we had what I call the plantation slavery things back in when people were chopping cotton and whatever, I wasn't aware, but at that time, prisoners were used. Prisoners were hired out at pennies for the hour or pennies by the day to work in the plantations. So they were sort of a, quote, slave labor, which, of course, slavery is a whole other topic I can get off onto, but I'll try not to, because we have more slaves now than we ever had back in the days when we had slaves. I don't know if you're aware of that. Human trafficking slaves, household slaves, it's pretty incredible. But whereas I have another idea, and again, part of my hope here is to inspire people to maybe think about what else we can do. But, we all like to be productive. And when people are not being productive, they get unhappy, they get depressed. And what I often want to do is tell people who are depressed, well, go volunteer at the SPCA. Spend a couple hours a week doing something. Now, I'm not talking about people who are so clinically depressed that they can't get out of bed, that they really have to take strong medication just to have any semblance of a normal life. But if you look at a little tiny child, which I have had several a while back, they want to produce. They want to show you what they've done. Everybody wants to produce. We all want to produce. We all do work. We're all here trying to learn something. We're all, we all like to produce. It's human nature to produce. It's human nature to join with other people, to be in a community. Production is one of those human nature things. When you take people and you put them on disability and you say, you can't produce, you can't work because you're mentally ill or because you're sick, I think that's a problem. I think that's one of the solutions, honestly, for getting people off of or out of some of the problems that are associated with mental illness, is to give them something to do. And right now we've got jails where they can't get out of their cell. We've got California, for example, has more ad seg than anybody on the planet. I mean, it's unbelievable. You go to prison in California, you're most likely going to end up in ad seg for no reason, just because they can do that, and they have a lot of, apparently, private cells available. Anyway, drug addiction is another big problem and another cause for recidivism. Multiple offenses. How many of us see rap sheets for our clients that have, you know, 20 offenses, possession of controlled substance, small amounts, grams, maybe less than ounces, stuff like that, possession less than a gram, possession less than a gram, possession less than a gram, possession with intent to sell because they got 3 grams in 3 baggies. That kind of stuff. It's just nuts. Drug addiction is a problem. It's related to homelessness. It's related to recidivism. And it's related to what we're doing here with normal, because once we recognize that some drugs, like alcohol, like marijuana, are probably okay for some people. Marijuana, I have to confess, makes my very best friend in the world, makes her throw up, okay? So it doesn't work for her. But a lot of us are able to enjoy the use of cannabis. Some people not. Same with alcohol. Addiction is now being defined in some part, at least, as a brain, as an actual brain thing. They can measure or find the brain part. My same friend who throws up if she tries to smoke marijuana or use marijuana, she's a geneticist. And I said, so where's the gene, Susie? Where is this gene that says you're going to be an addict or you're not going to be an addict? She said, well, it's not that simple. I said, that's what I don't want to hear. But it is. It's a set of genes. It's a set of genes. And then it's also, of course, probably associated with your social upbringing, your parental training, all the things that we do as a part of a community. But drug addiction is a big problem. Putting people in prison for drug addiction is probably a mistake. And our war on drugs was started as a promise to the public that we would get rid of these really, really bad guys who are making millions of dollars selling, you know, heroin to school children. It has morphed into something much more onerous than that. Now, everybody with a small amount, I remember a client I had in 20 years ago, they were charging him with possession of heroin for having a used syringe where he had shot up. But there was enough heroin that they could extract it through chemical means from the syringe that he was charged with a first-degree felony of possession of heroin. Give me a break. The other day I was in federal court. The fact that the defendant had was under the influence of a drug made them allege that he was in possession of the drug. I mean, we're crazy here, guys, and it's not getting any better. So what we're doing here with normal, I think, is hugely important in educating the people, educating the public, educating the courts about what needs to be done about drugs. Some drugs are worse than others. Some drugs, of course, will kill you, and are not. I'm not recommending everybody go out and try heroin this afternoon, or if you haven't already. But and there are stories in the Netherlands. I read once where a part of the Netherlands was going to reclassify marijuana as a serious narcotic along with heroin and cocaine because of the quality of the product. It's not what we had in 1971, right? It's a hugely different product. Other areas are not doing, are not following suit in that area, in that reclassification. And then the Netherlands, picking on them again, they decriminalized all narcotics at some point. I'm not sure what the status is of that now, and I've heard mixed reviews about it worked really well, it didn't work really well. We don't know. One thing that has worked is the needle exchange. All the cities have needle exchanges now, right? Everybody's got those. That's a good thing. It reduces the diseases that are brought about from using dirty needles with people who had some sort of problem before. Okay, 2010 report by the National Center of Addiction says that 65% of the nation's inmates meet the medical diagnosis criteria for addiction. So how do we treat addiction? And I'm talking about addiction. You know, we all have addictions. I'm addicted to air, okay? Air, water, food, friends, you know, those things probably won't kill me. Addiction to things that'll kill you, I think, is the problem. So addiction is sort of a normal state for humans, but not necessarily addictions to things that will kill us. And I would, you know, people don't start off having a beer at a party and say, I think I'd like to go shoot heroin now. you know, there's a thing that happens, and there has to be a certain sort of mental gymnastics that gets somebody to start to shooting heroin. And I would point out that there, I think, in every major office building that I'm aware of, people are active heroin addicts, going to work every day, having normal, stable jobs, supporting their dependents, all that. So it's not, I mean, it's not necessarily a killer drug, but it certainly can be. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent. It seems to me that U.S. is addicted to incarceration. We want to lock people up. We want to keep feeding this giant, whatever bad word you want to call it, of incarceration. And I think that we're doing God's work here, really, with decriminalizing marijuana and getting at least that portion of the population out of the prisons and out of the arrest and incarceration system. In 1985, when I began practicing law, every single case that I had, other than drug cases, mostly possession cases, the person, the actor, my client, was under the influence of alcohol. It just seemed to be really normal, right, back in the 80s. Now, it's also drugs and alcohol. You know, like, all drugs are not for every person. Alcohol is certainly not for every person. But now we've got a big problem with addiction, I believe, causing people to commit offenses that they wouldn't otherwise commit. The other thing that bothers me a lot right now, and it just came out of a bad trial last week, where the guy who turned 18 2 days before he killed a man, I believed in self-defense. Turned out it was not quite like that, probably. Jury didn't see it in my way, let me say that. But, you know, it's interesting to have a young person who's 18 years old who shows absolutely no remorse for killing someone. Now, I have a very close personal friend who some 20, 30 years ago was put in a situation where he did kill someone in self-defense, and it was clear self-defense, and the police and the grand jury agreed it was self-defense. He still talks about that as the most horrible moment of his life, killing that person. This 18-year-old kid, the day after the killing, I can't speak to his remorse, but the day after the killing, went to the deceased's car, and stole a bunch of stuff out of it, and went and hawked it. Within 12 hours of killing the guy, he's hawking crap out of his car. No remorse visible in the courtroom. No remorse when the father of the deceased is testifying about his son who was killed. Nothing. Get nothing. And I don't know what that's about, ladies and gentlemen, but it makes me really sad. And again, I don't know what that has to do with any of what I'm talking about, other than it just makes me sad about it. It's one of the issues, and I promise to bring you problems and not too many solutions, but I have a couple. Okay, so 11% of the 2.3 million inmates with substance abuse issues receive treatment. The lack of treatment, of course, is, guess what? Lack of funding, lack of facilities, lack of interest. When we're busy building prisons because it's lucrative, and we're busy doing whatever you do to do the criminal justice system because it's lucrative, we're not interested in not locking people up. Okay, so somebody else has to do the math because I cannot. $2.3 million if we save $90,000 each, as opposed to locking them up and making them unproductive and habituated to state support and to state institutional care, eat this now, go to the bathroom now, go outside for an hour now and walk around, but do not speak to any other person, etc. Okay, so in 2005, $74 billion spent on incarceration and related topics, $630 million spent on treatment and prevention. Can we flip that around? I mean, seriously, can we put the money into the work to prevent and to treat rather than to incarcerate? Yeah.
Do these numbers address, in New York we have a diversion program, so we have felony and misdemeanor drug courts, and so I guess before they get incarcerated,
you know, I can't answer that. And talk to me later, and I'll be happy to help try to look it up. And I've got some resources at the end of the slides that also may help you know, get more details about that. And again, this is a figure from 10 years ago, 11 years ago. So, and look, I mean, we did. I had a really smart law clerk helping me do this research, and she was unable to find current studies. So, but there's just a 10%, I'm looking at 10% incarceration expenditure versus a 10 times incarceration work expenditures versus the treatment and prevention. And it seems to me it needs to be flipped. Drugs, alternative drugs for treatment of drug addiction. We've got a bunch of them. Methadone has been around forever. It has its own problems, but it's also used successfully sometimes. Suboxone is another one, causes some other issues. And we've got a new one, or new to me, buprenorphine, which also seems to be working really well. The problem with these drugs, many of them are expensive and they're unavailable to the common man on the street, woman on the street who is unemployed, marred and unemployable because of a criminal history or a criminal history record. So they cannot afford the treatment. They self-medicate. They do what they can do. They drink and do whatever. So there are drugs that are being tested. It's a, you know, you want to invest in something. I'd invest in looking for drugs that can help treat drug addiction. And as I said, I'm not sure what the true root of drug addiction is, but it seems to be some biological brain issue as well as social factors around the particular individual. How many of our clients, you know, are completely fatherless and have always been? Fathers are in prison. Fathers are just never present. You know, the father has six children with six different women, none of whom are supported. Issues. We have social issues. One of the things that we have, the homelessness issue, camping, loitering, trespassing, panhandling. I remember being in San Francisco a few years ago, and there was a rule, the guys could be on the street, they could be standing on the corner, but they could not sit down. If they sat down, they could be arrested. Okay? So that's hardly a good place, and it's hardly a way to get them into doing something. I was working at that point with a mission there who we passed out sandwiches and tried to get the guys to at least come to church kind of thing. It was helpful and it was useful, and we took care of their children. I was there for a couple of weekends, but the staff there had a program with the children for after school. They had a safe place with a barred door locked tightly, with bulletproof, because there were bullets flying around night and day in that area, the San Francisco, my favorite city for other reasons. So the kids would have a safe place to work, a safe place to do their homework, a safe place to play ping pong or basketball, just kind of a safe place to hang out, a safe place to do graffiti on the walls. You know, a great place. We need more of those for young people. In my hometown of Houston, which is where I spend most of my time, the Salvation Army has numerous aftercare, after-school facilities where they take kids. They, first of all, help them with their homework. Second of all, teach them others. Teach them to play guitar. Teach them a different language. Teach them different things. Let them do art. Let them play sports. Salvation Army, I just want to make a short plug for that. 86% of the donations and the money that's taken in by the Salvation Army actually goes to the beneficiaries that they claim to support, rather than to the management, which another several other quote charitable organizations seem to be prone to, where the management's making hundreds or millions a year as salaries. Salvation Army, really, the money does go to help the people that they are promising to serve. Anyway, that's one of my many soapboxes. I don't know if y'all know Randy McGinn out of Albuquerque, probably one of the finest lawyers in the country. She is now a special prosecutor in a case where I have a few facts, but the main fact that I remember is that law enforcement found a homeless guy who had been camping. I think he'd been camping the same place for some time, but they shot and killed him. No apparent reason. But Randy is the special prosecutor against those law enforcement, and they are in for a ride, I promise you, with her working against them. Homeless people, I remember years ago, I was appalled to learn that when I was a very young lawyer, that homeless people would often commit some small offense so they could go to jail, so they could get three hots and a cot for Christmas or Thanksgiving or some time where they thought they needed just something other than digging in trash cans and living under a bridge. Fascinating to me. We've got to make it available to people. And I had enough homeless people in Santa Cruz and disabled people that they did do a pretty good job of, I don't know if that's what that noise is, but it could be my phone going off. Probably is. They did a pretty good job. They had homeless shelters. They had food shelters. The church that I went to there fed thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in an annual drive. So there's good work being done, and we can align ourselves with some of that, like we have aligned ourselves with Normal to do the good work of decriminalizing cannabis. So how do we deal with homeless? They don't need prisons, they need housing. Canada has gotten a project that they're proposing, $32,000 a year spent on homeless people that get arrested for homeless-related crimes. An outlay of $800 million would provide housing for all those people. In less than 4 years, building the facilities to house those people would save them. There would be break-even, and then they'd start to be, I guess, in the money somehow on that. So we've got three problems. We've got mental illness, drug addiction, and homelessness. And we've got three social issues with one common three-step process. That is, invest in the things that work and treat the underlying problems based on what we've learned from our investigation and our learning, and save money doing all that. I think it's an alarm saying I should get up or something. It's time. All right. We're here in the Magic Valley with Goldstein's hospitality and everybody else's hospitality, some of whom I don't know. Keith Stroop, of course, has been fighting for us forever. We're fighting prohibition. We have problems, serious problems, and I want to suggest that we point out to the powers that be, in some case, that marijuana is not the problem. Homelessness is a problem. Overcriminalization is a problem. Having this huge percentage of our population incarcerated is a problem. Mental illness is a problem. Those are problems that we need to deal with, not marijuana, not cannabis. Cannabis needs to be taken off the chart as a problem and just put aside, then focus our intelligence and our criminal justice system on the real problems that we have. I wanted to make a small pitch for this CD that Natman has producing, Natman Shea in Arizona, to support, and all the money, all the proceeds, 100% of them, will go to the Arizona Capital Representation Project. There's a CD that's cut. I think there's 6 or 8 tunes that are already cut. Original tunes, one of which is what Natman describes in his autobiography, honors Keith and Normal to some great degree. It's worth a listen. I play bass and sing a little harmony on some of the tunes. It's just, kind of fun. But we are recording in Arizona with a volunteer team of some great musicians, not me, but some of the great musicians and a great recording guy. So if there's anybody who's interested in that, talk to me, talk to Natman. And then I've got some resources that I set out here that may or may not be in your original materials that you got, but I won't bore you going through them. And thank you for letting me be here and speak. I'm so impressed with all y'all have done and with the program, and all of you are such great, fine people doing great work, and I'm just in awe of all of you. So thank you for allowing me to be a part.